as we come up on the 20th anniversary of this. And we're also seeing war right now taking place in Ukraine. The U.S. warning China not to send, that there's a red line if they send weapons to Russia. Interestingly, almost the same day that Secretary of State Blinken announced $600 million of U.S. weapons would be going to Taiwan. Can you talk about this and also how the war compares when in dealing with conflict and the economy around the world, what it does?
Well, first, I mean, obviously, some of these asymmetries that you point out don't make things better. They make things worse. I find it a little bit difficult to understand how we could have such blinkers on what we do, as you suggested by what you said. The second thing that concerns Linda Bilmes, who teaches at Harvard and wrote that book with me, we've been discussing how many of the lessons of the Iraq and Afghanistan war have not been learned. One of the points that we made is how expensive that war was. We estimated at the time $3 trillion. The true cost now has clearly exceeded that amount. Probably more like $5 trillion would be a bottom line estimate. But the American people were never taken in to told this was what it was going to cost. The accounting systems used by the government, by the Department of Defense, are designed to obscure the true costs. There are special budgets. Not even Congress fully discusses the entire comprehensive cost of these wars. And while I strongly support backing Ukraine and resisting the Russian invasion, I think it's important as a matter of public policy, that we have greater transparency and greater accountability, and that we look full on the cost as well as the as what the reasons for this war.
I wanted to ask you one of the key points I think you make often about income inequality, the growing income inequality in the United States and the world, is that it's not a result of market forces, but it's actually a result of concrete policies adopted by political leaders. I'm wondering, as we head into more decisions have to be made before the next presidential election by Congress in terms of its policies on the economy. What do you see as the key issues that have to be addressed that will not only lessen income inequality here, but around the world?
Yes, I mean, you put it well. I've often written that inequality, poverty is a matter of choice. Not of the people themselves, but of our policy frameworks that lead to the levels of inequality. A wonderful example of that was the ability of the Biden administration, by the acts it took in the responding to the pandemic, to reduce childhood poverty by an estimated 40-50% in 1 year. We could have done it at any time in the past. We could have adopted the policies which have this enormous effect on child poverty. The reason I talk so strongly about childhood poverty, children who grow up in poverty are not going to be learning, not going to be as productive, effective citizens. What we do today affects our economy, our society in the future. What worries me right now, for instance, is that the special emergency food that was given during the pandemic has just ended this month, or last month in February. And the result of that is that millions of children who were moved out of poverty by that emergency food assistance are now being moved back into poverty.
You're talking about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
That's right. And it's estimated that 4.2 million people above the poverty line in 2021 depended on those emergency assistance of SNAP. And the effect of that was to reduce poverty by 10% and childhood poverty by 14% in those states that had that assistance. So we ought to be recognizing that we are now making another set of choices, seemingly to increase poverty, a set of actions I find unconscionable. At the same time, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the Federal Reserve increasing interest rates, slowing the economy. It all sounds so technical. Let's be clear about what the Fed is trying to do. And it's been a little bit explicit about it. It wants to increase unemployment. Oh, that seems all like a, just a number. But increasing unemployment means that millions of people will have no jobs. Millions of people will move into poverty. Millions of people's lives will be broken. Education will be interrupted. And it is particularly going to affect certain subgroups within our population. For instance, when the Fed seemingly innocuously says, oh, we're trying to target increase unemployment to a number like 5%. Can you believe it? The government saying we want there to be more unemployment. What that means for minorities is that they're going to have unemployment rates twice that. And for minority, youth minority, four times that. That means the Federal Reserve wants there to be an unemployment rate of excess of 20% for these groups. Now, it would they should call on the government and the fiscal authorities to do everything they can to improve the safety net, improve training programs for those thrown out of work. I haven't heard a peep, not a word saying that these increases in interest rates have to be accompanied by these measures if we are not to going to increase the inequalities in our society, not going to increase the numbers of people in our society in poverty.
And at the same time, you have student loan forgiveness being challenged by the Supreme Court.
That's right. And again, some people are saying, oh, it's going to have enormous macroeconomic effects. That's wrong. We've looked at the numbers. It's very clear the effect on inflation is nil. The effect on aggregate demand is very, very low. The reason is obvious. These are lifetime debts. Just because much of this will never be paid back in any case, because you can't squeeze water out of a stone. But even for those who will be paying back, their annual payments are relatively low, and they're certainly not going to be willing or able to borrow to get their debts back to offset debt reduction. So the reality is that all this, what is going on in the courts, will have the effect of putting the chain of debt around the neck of millions of Americans, affecting how these young people can start their life, whether they can get married, whether they can buy a house, or even buy a car. Impeding their ability to search for a job better matched to their abilities. So in that sense, the evidence is pretty clear. When you have that kind of debt chained around the neck of young Americans, it actually hurts national productivity.
And Joe Stiglitz, I wanted to ask you about the recent announcement by Colombia's Minister of Finance, Jose Antonio Ocampo, to convene the first ever ministerial summit for the Latin American and Caribbean, or tax summit for the Latin American and Caribbean region. Do you have any hope that this will help put an end, an effective end to the abuse of tax havens and tax evasion by some of these, especially these some of the countries in the Caribbean that are notorious for hiding money?
Well, I think Ocampo's measure is very welcome. The response, I think, has been very positive. It's only one step, but it's an important step. Another important step was the EU's agreement to go ahead with a minimum tax, corporate minimum tax, that makes it more difficult for these tax havens to try to attract corporations, or at least to pretend that the profits were generated in these tax havens. So it's an important step, but a lot more is going to have to be done. The global proposal to have a global minimum tax was too weak. It was only 15%. It should be 25%. There was a worry that the effect of that agreement will be actually to lower tax rates in some countries, because many countries have a corporate minimum a corporate tax rate that exceeds the 15%. So I worry that the minimum will actually wind up being the maximum, and more corporations will not be paying their fair share of taxes. Go ahead.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we thank you so much for being with us. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, Columbia University professor, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, currently the chief economist of the Roosevelt Institute. Among his many books, People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. Coming up on this 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq coming up, we're going to speak with Mehdi Hasan, the broadcaster, MSNBC host, now author of Win Every Argument. Stay with us.
Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look?
Redemption Song by Bob Marley and the Wailers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Fox News host Tucker Carlson kicked off his first installment of analyzing footage from the deadly January 6th Capitol insurrection that was shared with him by Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy exclusively by playing cherry-picked clips on his top-rated Fox show Monday night.
They were peaceful, they were orderly, and meek. These were not insurrectionists, they were sightseers. Footage from inside the Capitol overturns the story you've heard about January 6th. Protesters queue up in neat little lines. They give each other tours outside the speaker's office. They take cheerful selfies and they smile. They're not destroying the Capitol, they obviously revere the Capitol. They're there because they believe the election was stolen from them. They believe in the system.
Tucker Carlson claimed the House January 6th committee withheld evidence about the attack on the Capitol by Trump supporters and said of the rioters, quote, they were right. In retrospect, it's clear the 2020 election was a grave betrayal of American democracy, unquote. This comes as Trump addressed the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, Saturday night as he campaigns for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination while facing multiple criminal investigations.
In 2016, I declared, I am your voice. Today, I add, I am your warrior, I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution, I am your retribution. Not going to let this happen.
I am your retribution, Trump said. Other speakers peddling Trump's big lie of election fraud got top billing at CPAC, where they addressed half-filled rooms while calling Trump the former and future president. For more, we're joined by Mehdi Hasan, journalist and author, host of weekly shows on MSNBC, nightly also on Peacock. His new book is titled Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. Congratulations on your book. No argument there.
Thank you.
Your take on President Trump and the case he's making for 2024?
So you played that clip from Trump at CPAC, and as I pointed out on my show on Sunday night, that was pure unadulterated fascism. I know some people, even on the left, don't like to use the F word in relation to Trump and Trumpism. But when a candidate for high office, a candidate who has previously incited an armed insurrection, when he stands up on stage and says, you put me back in office and I will be your retribution, that is straight out of the authoritarian playbook. That is rhetoric going back to the 1920s and 30s, I'm sorry to say. So he is not hiding this stuff. He's saying this stuff out in the open. We know what is on offer from Trump for 2024. We know what this country is in line for, were he to get back in. And let's not rule out. People say, oh, well, he can't win. Of course he can win. This is America. He's won before. There's an electoral college. Of course he could win. It's a two-party system. So for me, it's chilling rhetoric. It's not something I take lightly. He has created an army of mini-me's in Congress, the Marjorie Taylor Greens of this world. He has people like Kevin McCarthy still covering for him, providing that footage, as you mentioned, to Tucker Carlson, who then lies about it on air. Tucker Carlson, who tells Dominion in a lawsuit, I don't believe in the big lie, under oath, but then goes on TV to say he does. The cynicism of Fox and of the Trump enablers never ceases to amaze me, Amy.
Mehdi, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this issue of authoritarianism, I don't know if you saw there was a piece by Chris Hedges, the former New York Times reporter recently, where he calls the crowd in the January 6th protest and insurrection deplorable. But at the same time, he claims that he believes that there has been excessive government crackdown on them to the point that many people are being sentenced to long sentences for what are essentially minor crimes. He lays out the case that this is actually creating more divisions in the country than necessary. I don't know if you've seen the piece, but what you think about how the government has handled the protesters?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen the piece. And I think anyone who thinks, let's just have a very simple thought experiment. If the hundreds of people who had attacked the Capitol, injured more than 140 officers, threatened the lives of members of Congress, had been black, had that been a mass crowd of Muslims, of people who look like me with my name, I can assure you, and I can assure Chris Hedges, the sentences would be far longer, the prisoners would have been treated much worse, and there would be no political support, as there is from one political party for these quote-unquote political prisoners. They're not. They're people who launched an armed insurrection on the Capitol. So I don't agree that they've been treated in an excessive way. Now, has there been an over-focus on the foot soldiers of the insurrection while the ringleaders and the insiders have gotten off? That I completely agree with. Has the Department of Justice, has our political and judicial and legal systems and our media gone only after the people who were ransacking the Capitol and going after members of Congress and assaulting police officers? Yes, because at the expense of the people in charge? Yes. I mean, I'm amazed that we are more than 2 years out from this and Donald Trump is running for president. Think about how the rest of the world sees us. A president who lost an election, refused to leave office, claimed he hadn't lost, incited an armed insurrection, then left office, went to his exile in Florida and carried on inciting more insurrections, is now running for office again and polling pretty well. Like, what would we say if we saw that in another country? Our democracy is broken. Our judicial system clearly cannot handle a Republican Party that is effectively pro-insurrection. And I think, you know, anyone who says that these people have been dealt with excessively needs to Google the term white privilege.
I wanted to ask you, you've also been very vocal and followed the restrictions of voting rights all across the country. Your sense of the impact this is going to have on our next election?
I think we don't know is the honest answer. We had the midterms that came along. Some of us were warning, look, this is a really important midterm election. Thankfully, voters in states, in key swing states, rejected election deniers for the Secretary of State positions in places like Michigan, in places like Arizona, in places like Georgia. They rejected gubernatorial candidates who are election deniers in places like Arizona. Carrie Lake still refusing to accept she lost in true Trumpian fashion. So that was a good sign that came out of the midterms. Now, my worry, and I've said this on my show, is let's not be complacent. The threat to democracy is not over. I have said on the record that the Republicans controlling the House of Representatives, we don't know whether they'll control the House of Representatives come January 2025. It's likely they will. They control it currently. That's a real problem because I don't see a House of Representatives led by Kevin McCarthy and Marjorie Taylor Greene in January 2025 agreeing to certify the election. I think we're in no man's land come January 2025. And I think there's enough election deniers still in local levels that could cause problems. I think there's enough voter suppression laws that can cause problems. Look at Florida, where the majority of Floridians voted in 2018 to restore voting rights to former felons, disproportionately black former felons. And Ron DeSantis has led a crusade, both at the political level and judicial level, to reverse that decision, the decision of the people of Florida in his supposedly free state of Florida. So the Republicans are not sleeping on this. They're not relaxing on this. They are taking every possible measure to try and restrict the vote, to try and limit young people from voting, people of color from voting, because they know they can't win otherwise. Nikki Haley said it herself at CPAC. Seven of the last presidential elections, the Republican Party has lost the popular vote. They know that.
When we're talking on the 58th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which was happened in just 2 weeks after the 58th, after the assassination of Malcolm X. But I want to turn to your book, Mehdi, Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. And I want to refer to a moment that you talk about where you're interviewing in October 2020, John Bolton, who yes. who was the Bush White House National Security Advisor. He was promoting his memoir, The Room Where It Happened, and he came on your show. This is what happened.
The reality is hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died. There was torture, millions of refugees, and that did follow from the decision by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and others in the administration like yourself to invade Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of people died. And just to go back to my question, which you didn't answer, do those deaths never weigh on your conscience was my question, which you didn't answer.
No, I did answer it, and I'll answer it again since you didn't seem to listen to it. The fact was, after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, a number of decisions could have been made in different ways.
With respect, John Bolton, you weren't a pundit on Fox News then. You were in government. I don't remember you quitting in objection to the occupation. And the fact is, that occupation, let me just finish my question and you come back in. That occupation produced thousands of dead, torture, refugees. Richard Clark, who was White House counterterrorism czar at the time, shortly after 9/11, called it war crimes. Kofi Annan called the war illegal. I just wonder, do you ever worry that, you know, people have tried to do citizens' arrests on you in the past. Do you ever worry you may have to face a court to answer for that war and that occupation, for the war crimes that happened back then?
Of course not, because what you're saying is completely ludicrous. And those who made those kinds of criticisms are not reflecting what actually happened.
So that is Mehdi Hasan questioning the former Bush National Security Advisor, John Bolton. And I just wanted to read a little paragraph from The Guardian talking about you. For those who criticize the news media as too white, too Christian, too complacent, too inward-looking, too pompous, too prone to herd mentality, and too deferential to authority, Hasan has come along in the nick of time, a British-born Muslim of Indian descent, anti-establishment muckraker, unabashed lefty with a bias towards democracy. Talk about this in the context of the argument you're making in Win Every Argument, what it means not to go on bended knee to power.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on to talk about the book. Quick correction. John Bolton was the Trump National Security Advisor. Under George Bush, he was
a State Department official. Right. Sorry about that.
So he came on the show shortly having left the administration. I mean, the Bolton interview is a good example of what The Guardian very nicely said about me, which is I interviewed him in 2020. We're now at the 20th anniversary. That was, 17 years in. And I was amazed that no one had just asked him a very direct question, which is, how do you kind of sleep at night? How do you deal with all the deaths on your conscience? We can argue the rights and wrongs of the Iraq War. I clearly think it was wrong. He clearly thinks it was right. But no one's really asked him about his moral responsibility for everything that went down. And when I asked him about it, he ran from that debate. Oh, now he tried to separate out the occupation from the war. He just said things are ludicrous or inaccurate without dealing with the substance of what I was saying, which was obviously 100% true about the deaths and torture and refugees. And I feel like, you know, unfortunately, it's required someone like myself to come in and say, why are we not asking these questions? These are questions that people have. These are legitimate questions. And for far too long, too many interviewers in America have been a little too deferential, in my view, to people in power, whether they're Republican or Democrat, whatever it is. And I come from a British media culture. The British media has many problems, has its own deference to people in power, but in terms of TV interviews, has a culture and tradition of much more outspoken, much more combative interviews. And I've tried to bring that with me into the US media on my show on MSNBC and on my show on Peacock. And to try and give, you know, I used to work at Al Jazeera English prior to joining MSNBC, and the motto there was give voice to the voiceless. When I'm doing an interview, I'm trying to think, what questions would an audience member who would never get a chance to sit down with a John Bolt, what would they want to ask? And I try and ask those questions, and I try and get an answer. That's another important point that I make in the book. If you're having a debate, an argument, an interview, and someone is gaslighting you, trying to steamroll you with nonsense, don't budge. Don't move on to the next question. Don't allow them to distract or deflect. Don't budge. Follow up. Stick to your topic.
And, Mehdi, speaking of people in power, I'd like to ask you about Joe Biden. Unlike many on the left of the spectrum in America, you have a kinder assessment of his role as president so far, even though you were skeptical didn't really initially support his candidacy. Yeah. Wondering your if you could talk about that assessment.
So I'm going to push back on the premise of your question and say many on the left, a lot of lefties I've met are surprisingly, positively surprised by what Biden has achieved. You can take Bernie Sanders at the top of that list. You can take members of the squad who have all been like, wow, we didn't expect some of this stuff. Obviously, he's not been as left-wing or progressive as we would have liked, but certainly more than we imagined. I never imagined he would be the Democratic nominee. I thought he wouldn't win the primaries. I didn't think I worried whether he would be able to beat Trump. He did beat Trump. So he proved me wrong twice. And then I thought he would be a classic centrist neoliberal president. And again, third time, he surprised me. You look at what he's achieved in some of his legislation from the American Rescue Plan, which was one of the biggest poverty reduction acts in modern memory. You look at what he achieved with the Inflation Reduction Act and the record spending on climate change. Again, not enough, but more than his predecessors. You know, life is relative. I can only compare him to other presidents. And he's done far more than Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, his Democratic predecessors. I think it's fair to say he has achieved more legislatively than any president going back to LBJ, maybe even back to FDR. And people just don't look at the results. Now, has he done enough on immigration? Not at all. I'm not a fan of his recent immigration moves. I'm not a fan of some of the stuff he's done on COVID. I'm not a fan of his Israel-Palestine policy, of course. But then take Afghanistan. The man ended the longest war in American history. And he did it at great personal political cost. You look at his polls, people forget this. Joe Biden's polls first took their nosedive in August of 2021 when he pulled out of Afghanistan with the entire Beltway media, the entire DC political establishment saying, don't do it. This is a mistake. This is a disaster. And he did it. And I think you've got to give credit where credit's due. Now, as I say, there are many things I will continue to criticize him on. And I've had his members of his administration on my show and I've challenged them. But on the big picture, he is, without a shadow of a doubt, whether we like it or not, the most center-left president of our lifetimes. Now, is that a low bar? Yes. But has he exceeded it? Yes.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, but you had Senator Peter Welch on your show this weekend, who is supporting Bernie Sanders' call to debate conditioning aid to Israel. And you talked about the reference to what's happening, what the Israeli soldiers are doing in the West Bank as a pogrom.
Yeah, so that was an Israeli general who used that word. And I'm glad that American politicians led by Bernie Sanders are starting to talk about this aid debate, that we cannot just give billions and billions of dollars to Israel every year as they carry out massive human rights abuses, pogroms, ethnic cleansing. We keep saying it's shared values. That's why we support Israel. Well, these are not shared values. And I'm glad that Democrats increasingly slowly are starting to speak up. Let's see if the rest of them do.
Mehdi Hasan, we thank you so much for being with us. Journalist and author, host of shows on MSNBC and Peacock. His new book is Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.